Chapter 4, we left off at the end of chapter 4. It says, so the people believed. Remember, Moses was sent back to him. God sent, took him out of the desert in Sinai and sent him and Aaron because Moses was being whiny about the fact that he didn't speak. And God said, okay, I'll send Aaron with you. They went back and they spoke to the people. God gave them the miracles, right? Miracles that were very impactful to those people. Again, for 400 years, they had lived, that's a bunch of generations. It's like 10 plus generations. They had lived under the dominance of a Pharaoh. He gave them three miraculous things that were pretty amazing. Again, the symbol of the power of Egypt was in the cobra, right? They wore it on their heads. They wore it. It was a sign of their a right to rule and right to dominate the people. And God said, Moses, throw your staff down and I'll pick it up by the tail, and came back and overruled that power. Same thing with, they were very into medicines. They were very into, they're very educated, probably the most educated civilized people on the face of the earth at the time. But leprosy was something they could do nothing of that ravaged them. And God healed the leprosy and showed wisdom beyond that. And then the Nile, which was the baseline of all power in Egypt. The Nile was the root of their wealth, the root of their, it changed everything. It was such a rich, fertile place because of the Nile Delta and the water and fertile soil that was there. So that, what's it say? It says, so the people believed. This is the, all the elders and the Hebrew people said the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed down and worshiped. So here, this is sweet. All of a sudden the people have hope, right? And they're excited and they worship. And then we come to chapter 5, right? Chapter 5, I don't know. I'm sure all of you have read it, right? Because you're all reading ahead and doing it. Levi? Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do with you. So, in chapter 5, all of a sudden, the enemy sees this. The enemy sees that these people bowed low and worshiped the Hebrew God. And this is worship Yahweh. Worshiped Him. God saw that. And the enemy saw that. And the conflict began. As it often does. I think one of the more dangerous periods of time when I watch people is God woos people and God starts drawing people to himself. That's when the enemy gets stirred up. And it seems like the struggle begins as God begins to woo people and call them to himself. The enemy perks up and goes, I'm not going to let this happen. And here it is. Remember, Egypt is a symbol, is a figure of the world. The pharaohs are like a symbol of the enemy of God. And the pharaoh called himself a god, right? The pharaoh saw himself as a god, and the people worshipped him and respected him and served him as a god. And yet you have this Hebrew God that's here. So chapter 5, it says, and afterward, Moses came and said to Pharaoh, after these people were excited and they bowed down, the people said, all right, good. God is concerned about us. God cares. And afterwards, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. And besides, I will not let Israel go. Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. But the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors. And Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors. So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and their foremen, saying, you are no longer to give the people straw to make brick as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of the bricks which they were making previously, you shall impose upon them. You are not to reduce any of it because they are lazy. Therefore they cry out, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let the labor be heavier on the men, and let them work at it, that they may not pay no attention to false words. So the taskmasters, the people, and the foremen went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I am not going to give you any straw. You go and get straw for yourselves wherever you can find it, and none of your labor will be reduced. So the people scattered all throughout the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. And the taskmasters pressed them, saying, complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you had straw. Moreover, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters set over them, the foremen were probably Hebrews. The foremen of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not completed your required amount, either yesterday or today, in making bricks as previously? Then the foreman of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, why do you deal this way with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants, yet they keep saying to us, make bricks, and behold, your servants are being beaten. But it is the fault of your own people. But he said, you are lazy, very lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice the Lord. So now go and work. For you shall be given no straw, yet you must deliver the quota of bricks. And the foremen of the sons of Israel saw that they were in trouble because they were told, you must not reduce your daily amount of bricks. When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them. And they said to them, may the Lord look, the foremen, these Hebrew men, said to Moses and Aaron, may the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you brought harm to this people? Why did you ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak your name, he has done harm to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all. Sounds a little discouraged, right? Here's the verse before. They had hope. So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed down low and worshiped. Behind hope, disappointment is rooted in hope. What was the baseline when we started Exodus? And I would say a theme throughout the Bible that I think is so critical, right? That God has a plan, and God is at work in his plan, right? God has a plan. He has a perfect plan. He's at work in that. That's happening. Then, now, throughout the theme of the Bible, very obviously depicted in the book of Exodus, but it seldom looks like we think it's going to look. Right? And we need to, that is, I think, true throughout the Bible, and I would contend true in our lives. Right? God has a plan, but it seldom looks like we think it's going to look. It seldom works out like we think. We usually know better. We usually have a better idea how it would work out best, and how it would look, and how it would figure out. And if it went this way, that would be the best way for it to go. Right? That's how we usually figure life out. And then things don't go that way. And what do? We get discouraged. And we get disappointed. Marriage, work, finances, life, house, purpose, what am I doing with my life, careers, all the things that we get discouraged in because they don't look the way they thought it was going to. I would contend that most of us have been through a period of life, especially about the 10-year marriage thing, like a bunch of you guys are in, somewhere about then. You look and go, I didn't think it was going to look like this. I had a different idea what it would look like by now, right? I mean, 10 years, that means 10 years of it getting way better, right? And in 10 years, it was better than when you got married, right? And most of us start into marriage with a lot of deficit and a lot of sad things, a lot of baggage that's not dealt with. And as a result, 10 years in, most of us Most marriages, there's a 10-year deal in counseling marriages. 10 years, man. If you can get past 10 years, you know, it's kind of like the same, like a puppy, you know? If you can not kill the puppy in the first year, maybe it's got hope, okay? See? So I mean, it's the same thing in 10 years of marriage. If you can not kill your spouse in 10 years, there's hope, right? But in our culture, what do we say? Ah, I don't like him anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. It wasn't what I thought. It isn't how I planned. And we walk away from it because that's culturally acceptable and it's what it is. How do we deal with that? Because here's Moses. Again, this is a picture of us. God came, showed his people, told Moses that I will deliver you, that I care about you, showed that to his people. His people were excited. They had great hope and they worshiped, right? But the conflict started. The clash of the powers, the clash of the titans. We often forget that's what's going on in this world, right? I mean, it's amazing. A lot of people want to believe in God, but they don't want to believe in the devil. It's a pretty ridiculous concept. The devil is alive and well on planet Earth. Is he defeated ultimately? Absolutely. Does he act like that? No. Will he fight until he's cast into eternal darkness, not allowed to harass us anymore? He will fight, I believe. And is the devil powerful? He is. I mean, I was raised in, you know, we were raised in conservative evangelicalism, which kind of said that, oh, you don't have to worry about the devil. Well, I don't think I should fear the devil. You know, I think I should fear God, and the only one I should fear is God. But don't be a fool. The devil is alive and well on planet Earth. And work a lot of the things that we see going on, there's a war going on. This is not about life is all good, and as long as I'm good, life is all good, and all I add God to it, and life gets really good doing it. No, there's a war going on. And if we begin to truly pursue God, one of the attributes I see in somebody's life, if somebody's life is going all well, everything's all good, you have no problems, I think, I don't know. I don't know if that looks like a life-serving God. Right? Because there's going to be conflict. In this world, there will be conflict. We were promised that. There's some churches that will say differently. There's a lot of strains of supposed Christianity that will say differently. Bring God into your life and everything will be good. Right? Bring God into your life and your finances and God will take care. All you gotta do is believe in God and He will take care of all your problems. God just wants to bless you and God just wants to make you happy. And God just wants you to be a spoiled little brat. Right? I don't see that in the Bible. In fact, the Bible, I would say Jesus is pretty clear that is not going to be the way it goes. In, you know, in Matthew 11, well, there's a bunch of them. In John 16:33, let me read that real quick. Because this is Jesus. He says, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace." Okay? Can we have peace in the midst of conflict? That is, it's a peace that surpasses all understanding He promises us, right? That means that it goes beyond explanation. Like, you shouldn't be at peace right now. Do you realize your life's a wreck? You know? Do you realize things are a wreck around you? He says, "These things I have spoken to you, you may have peace. In this world, you have tribulation. But I've overcome the world." There will be tribulation. There will be disappointment. There will be discouragement in this world. If that is not the case, you're either delusional and not facing reality, right? Or you're hugely being blessed by the, I would contend, by the enemy. Often stirs it up. I'm of the opinion that the vast majority of prosperity at this point in our country is not God's blessing on this country. It's the enemy drawing people away from God. Prosperity and wealth, are they drawing people to God? Or drawing people away from God? Is the enemy able to bless? Yeah. Does the enemy know how to bless people? He does. you say, well, he doesn't do that. He's just wicked and evil. And it looks like a devil with a pitchfork and red thing. Then that's the devil thing, you know. If it looks good, do you realize he's an angel of light? That he is the prince of the power of this world, that he owns and controls this world. God is ultimately in control? Absolutely. God is ultimately in control. But for this period of time, the enemy, you have one of two choices who you're going to serve. You're either going to serve God or you're going to serve the enemy. And if you serve the enemy, then he, in this culture particularly, he will prosper you. In other cultures, it's different. Is the enemy's culture, or is the enemy's nature to make you happy or to appease you or to give you any sort of rest? No, he's wicked and evil. His desire is to destroy. The distinction is that he's got a long-term plan and he sees things from an eternal perspective. And he is certainly willing to do whatever means necessary to keep you from spending eternity with the King of Kings, to worship, keep you from worshiping God. And he's willing to, for this short snap of time that we're on this earth, to pretend like life is good. It's really, in this world though, again, the thing that we have to keep in perspective, and we talked about this several weeks ago. How do we keep in perspective when life is a disappointment? How do we deal when God's plan doesn't look like we thought it was supposed to look? Have any of you ever felt that way? Like, this doesn't look like I thought it was going to look? I would hope you'd be honest, you know? Have any of you ever been discouraged or disappointed, or this isn't going the way I thought it was going to go? So how do we deal with that in process? And we talked about how to deal with that in process. We talked about there being three things that are really, that are important to help us not be surprised in our day of trouble. To not be surprised when things don't go the way we thought it was going to be. One of them we talked about is first off, acknowledge our limitations, right? Just to remind us of this, because it's important. We have to remember that we are not God. We have to remember that we are not omniscient. We have to remember that we are not omnipotent. We have to remember that we are not sovereign. We have to remember that we are very limited, and God is not. And our perspective and the way that we view things is very skewed by our limitations and by our perspective of life. God's isn't. We have to realize that God is God and I am me. And we aren't the same. In fact, we aren't even close. I am not the smart one in this deal, you know. My dad knows what's best for me. I don't. You know, any of you as dads realize that oftentimes in your children's life, they're going to be disappointed in you. If you're a good dad, let me just say this, they will be disappointed in you. Okay? They will be discouraged. Why? Because I can't go over to my friend's house. Okay? Why? Because dad knows best. Alright? Dad, this is not what I think is the best thing for you to do, or whatever it might look like. And the kid doesn't understand, right? He doesn't understand why. Why can't I? Why can't I do this? Why can't I have a cell phone at 10? You know? Whatever it may be. You know? Why can't I? All my friends do. Dad knows best. We are children. We are children and God is God. We have to keep in mind, like that child hopefully will do, and go, ultimately I know Dad loves me. Ultimately I know Dad is trustworthy. I trust that Dad has my best interests in mind. Even though I'm mad, it doesn't feel like it right now. Okay, it's important to realize that perspective. The other one is that we need to read the Bible honestly, right? These are the three things we talk about. How to deal with when things don't look like we're supposed to look like. When God's plan does not look like I thought it was going to look like. How to read the Bible honestly. It's a very common thing these days, and I don't do Facebook, but to post, pull a verse out of context, throw it up there and go, see, God wants you to be happy. It says this, right? See, God says he'll take care of it. See, prosper you. See, you're a child of the King, and that's what your life should look like always, as a child of the King. And if you have a good relationship, you're going to look like a child of the King. You know, you have this whole genre of preachers, right, who think that it is that they're loving on their people by driving around in a limo and having gold chains and gold rings and whatnot. Because see, if you have a relationship with God like me, see where it'll lead you? See, God will prosper your life. That's not reading the Bible honestly. Is that what it looks like? Is that what it looks like in the Bible? Because there's a lot of people that their lives didn't look like they thought it was going to look like. You know? John the Baptist? Right? Here's a guy that Jesus said, of all men born, of all humans born of human flesh, there's not a greater man. Right? This man spent his life knowing what he was called to do, to be the forerunner of the Messiah. He lived his life in holiness and righteousness. Jesus said that about him. I didn't, okay? Again, if I have a, you know, on your gravestone, probably nothing better to be written, right? There was not a greater man, right? Do you think his life went the way he thought it was going to go? I don't think so. God told him to speak truth. He spoke truth, right? Said the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time, you know. Something about somebody sleeping with who they shouldn't be sleeping with, and where this is being sexually immoral, and this isn't a good thing doing it, and he got thrown in prison. Do you think he was a little discouraged? I think he was discouraged. He said, told his guys, hey, go ask Jesus. Let's just make sure of this, because it don't seem to be going the way I thought it was going to go, okay? Said, go ask him what he's thought about. Are you really the Messiah, or do we look for someone else to come? Because this doesn't seem to be going the way it was supposed to go. So he did. And Jesus came back with a quote. It's a very interesting quote. But he prophesies of the Messiah, quotes the Old Testament prophecy of Messiah. But John was left in prison and died and was beheaded. Right? I don't think that was what he thought how it would go. Right? I doubt if any of the disciples thought it would go that way. You're gonna die a martyr? When they were sitting in the Last Supper, what were they going? Hey, can I be a head of state? What do you think? You know? You got any positions, man? Maybe like the ambassador to, I don't know where, Syria, somewhere? Mongolia? I don't know where. You know, these guys were in there thinking Jesus, the Messiah, is going to be set up. And then ultimately, the thing that we need to remember to keep us from being discouraged, and it encompasses all of them, is the cross, right? Did that go like anybody thought it was going to go? No. No, here's anybody since a prophetic time, since the beginning, talking about the Messiah, about the Lamb, about the perfect Lamb. I know it says he shed blood, but they thought when the Messiah came, he was going to set up and rule and reign and over the whole world from Jerusalem. Right? That's what they thought. And they were convinced of that. And it was proven here too, right? Said it here. Understandably. We Monday morning quarterbacks, so we can see something different. If it would be to see it otherwise if we weren't Monday morning right here doing it, just like them. And they thought that was going to happen. Very discouraged. All the disciples. But what does the cross, what is the cross? The cross, the thing that we always have to remember, the thing that should be the baseline of our lives, is that God loves us unconditionally. God absolutely loves us. His love is not conditional, is not based on my goodness. His love, while we were sinners, Christ died for us. He killed his son in my place. You know, it doesn't matter how bad things are going. If that's the baseline of your life. If that's what you really, really believe. So what happened in this deal? So those are things that we need to keep in line. We need to read the scriptures, because time after time you'll see stories. Read Jeremiah sometime, right? I mean, the boy was told, go preach my word, right? Speak. You'll change. you will determine the world and what goes on in the world. Go change nations. And then he's left bloody in a ditch. Stripped naked. Beaten. Every time he spoke, they beat him up and rejected him. You think he scratched his head and goes, this doesn't seem like I thought it would be. I mean, God, you gave me a prophecy and it doesn't seem like what I thought it would be. So let me just encourage you all. Guess what life's going to look like? Probably not the way you thought it was going to be. And what are we going to, Moses, here's Moses in this place trying to encourage these people. And the world, Pharaoh, comes in with all his power and reign and just discourages him, just disappoints him, just completely deflates him in the deal. Why did that happen? What are the things that exasperate disappointment? What are the ways that we go down that make disappointment control us rather than us being able to have peace? In this world, you will have turmoil. But I give you peace. Because that's really what matters, right? I mean, as long as I'm at peace, as long as I have hope, it doesn't really matter what's going on around me. But how do I not be determined by the things around me? There's a couple things that happened in this process that led him to this. And I want us to, there's an interesting word for servant. You know, the word serve and worship, not always, there's another word for worship that is in Exodus, it's used, is the same word. Right? To serve and to worship. The Hebrew word is, abad. And it means, and it's translated both ways, to worship and to serve. A servant's ebed. But the word is a root word. And that's when God told Moses, this will be evidence that I'm here for you, right? Remember when he was on the mountain, he said, in the front of the burning bush? And he says that when you lead the people out of Egypt, you will come back to me and worship me on this mountain. The word was abad. And it means to serve. What's important here is, who do these people, you know, there's a pretty interesting dialogue that happens with these people when they got discouraged and disappointed that often happens with us. He said then in verse 15, he says, then the foreman of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh saying, why do you deal this way with your servants? There is no new straw given to your servants. You keep saying to us, make bricks, and behold, your servants are being beaten. But it is the fault of your own people. They lost the fight because of fear. They lost the fight because of the oppression that Pharaoh put on them. And they went back to serving the world. You know, back to serving Pharaoh. They called themselves servants. Out of the Most High God. Worshippers. The same word. Right? If you say servants, it is, oh yeah, because they were slaves. Because slave is the word. It's not, servant seems like, you know, somebody who feeds me, you know, is my server at dinner or something on doing that. But we're talking slavery here. Okay? Again, we are either slaves to the Most High God, or we are slaves to the enemy of God. Right? You can't do both. And Jesus was clear about it. He says you can't serve God and mammon. You can't serve God and wealth. In our culture, you know, I would contend that a lot of our discouragements typically in our society are around wealth and money. Right? And things. Wealth and money and things that have to do with money, things that would be cured with money. Wouldn't all of our problems be cured if we just had a little more money? Right? Right? Is that not a natural inclination for names to think of, I just had another, I don't know what, 100,000? Be good, right? I mean, 100,000, I could pay off any debt and I'd be good, right? Get a new gun, you know? Life would be good, right? But what is somebody who has 100,000 more than me, which is probably about $100,000? What is somebody who has 100,000 more than me? You know, what do they say? If I just had 500,000 more, if I just had 500,000, I'd be happy, right? In this valley, one of the great things about raising kids in this valley to me was, you know, a lot of people said when we moved up here 30 years ago, oh, it's a terrible place to raise kids. They'll get spoiled. Well, there's a lot of spoiled brat kids here, right? But you know what the good thing about it is there, I can say to him, you know what Solomon said? Solomon said money won't bring you happiness. So I'm going to tell you, money won't bring you happiness. And I'll go, how do you know, Dad? You know? I mean, you know, you've never really had money. You know? I mean, it's not that we were without, but there's people with money up here, right? And they're clients of mine, right? And people that we know, people come over to our house for dinner. Like, not, you know, the guy who has 500,000 more than me, what's he say? If I just had $1 million, man, right? If I could just win the lottery, if I just had $1 million. The guy with $1 million says, what if I just had? It never ends. Never ends. The guy with 10 million says, if I just had 100 million. The guy with 100 million says, if I just had 1 billion, I'd be happy, right? You know what? They're never happy. It's a lie, but it is something that is, all of us have this feeling in our culture because we're so conditioned to believe a little bit more money and I wouldn't have so much stress, right? And I could have a couple of things that I really want, right? And wouldn't have to work so much. And all the things that we think it would cure and fix, and we're often disappointed in life. And discouraged in life because we're in this stinking struggle, it seems like, right? It's hard to get anywhere. It's hard to get ahead. But one of the good things about disappointment, one of the good things about discouragement, we could call that, we talked about last week about, or last couple weeks about, do not run from the desert experience, right? That it is really important that when we're in a desert, and it doesn't matter what the circumstances around us are. I'm talking about a desert in our soul. I'm talking about, what do? I don't know what to do. I feel hopeless. I feel like I'm on a little hamster wheel going around, going nowhere. You know, there seems like there's no hope in my marriage, or my kids aren't doing well, or, you know, whatever it might be that is. It seems like a dry time. It seems like a lonely time. It seems like I'm hungry and thirsty. It seems like God is not here. You know, I would contend that is a state that would be a discouraged time, right? Or a disappointed time on doing it. One of the good things about that is it's a revelation of our heart. One of the ways to make a desert time what God would intend for it to be is to reveal our heart. Because where does disappointment come from? Crushed hope, right? What do I have my hope in? And it's a very, when I'm disappointed or discouraged, I should ask myself, hey buddy, okay. Nice shoes. Is it here? Okay. We should ask ourselves, what is the true desires of my heart? Right? If I'm discouraged, if I'm disappointed, the revelation of what is hope lost? What are really the desires of my heart that don't seem to be going? What is it that puts me in this state? Is it money? Is it jobs? Is it, you know, the Jesus is pretty clear, where your money is, that's where you serve. He says you can't serve two masters, right? In all of this, it's easy to stand in this room right here, I would assume. I don't know the new couple here and their financial status on doing it, but it would be easy to stand in this here and go, well, we're not rich, right? I mean, we're not like those guys. I mean, I don't have a jet. I mean, come on. I mean, I have my own house that I live in, you know, doing it. I know they have a couple right now because they're, you know, they have one in California or something. But, I don't, I harass you because I like it. That's why. So, but most of us try to compare ourselves and go, we're not wealthy. I don't think about, but do we? Do we get disappointed by monetary things, by financial stuff, by work? Because that's a revelation of who we serve. Right? What did the enemy do to them? Let their labor be heavy on the men and let them work at it so that they may pay no attention to false words. You know, I would contend that most of us, if not all of us in this world, in this room, are far more disciplined and put far more effort into our job, our responsibilities in this world than we do to pursuing God. You know, far more time, far more disciplined effort. What are we serving? What is it that is, are we serving, and this is the ploy of the enemy. Let their labor be heavy on the men and let them work at it that they may pay no attention what he would consider to be false words to the things of God. You know? Most of us as men put somewhere, you know, 40 hours in this week or something, right? Or work this week, women too, right? How much time did you go here? How much time did you spend here? How much time did you spend pursuing the true and living God, to worshiping him, to serving him? And yet we wonder, why am I disappointed, you know? Why am I discouraged? Why don't things be going well? You know what it... Remember that statement? The omnipotent power of God will be revealed through obedience. Does God tell us to pursue him? If you read the Bible, it's amazing. All of us want to go, yeah, God, I want you to, so show up, okay? But I'm busy right now, so come on. Come on. Come on. Come with me. Hang out with me and do it, because I got stuff I got to do, right? And you want to show yourself to me? Show you. I'm up, but I'm kind of around, so come on. Let me go. I mean, how do we go after our relationship with God? Do we say, I'll get to you when I get to you? If we worshiped or served, if we served our bosses or our job or our occupation or our work the way we serve God, how would that be going? Probably would be in deeper financial disappointment, right? Right? Yeah, how would it be going? So the enemy comes at him hard. How did it get them to be discouraged? They went from saying they bowed low and worshiped God, served God. They were going to go worship him on the mountain, as Moses had told them that was going to happen, that we will go. He told them to let my people go, that we can go worship God. And yet they turn around and they got beat up and beat down by the things of this world, by the work, and being consumed by it and being tired and being beaten. Rather than having hope, they became discouraged. And then they said, times in those verses I read, they said, we are your servants, Pharaoh. You're who we serve. None of us would say we worship money, right? Nobody in here, right? Because we're Christians in a church, right? We don't worship money. Really? Do we serve it? You know? Does it determine our daily lives? Does it determine our effort? Is that where we put? Does it determine our hope? Or do we Don't get me wrong. God intends for us to work, right? He said, yep, you guys are a bunch of sinful men that's entered the world, and therefore you're going to become just a bunch of lazy perverts. So I'm going to tell you, you're going to have to struggle to make a living, right? The ground is not going to give it up, because that's going to be a route of sanctification for you. How to grab yourself by the butt and get up and do what you don't want to do. How to learn some level of discipline. How to cry out to God. Because when the ground doesn't give it up, if our jobs and what we're doing in our daily lives don't cause us to cry out to God, we've lost our perspective of life. That doesn't mean because it's so hard and so difficult and I'm so beat up by it. How about the people you're working next to? How about the people that you're in contact with on a daily basis? If you aren't crying out to God, God help me. What is my purpose here? My purpose here is God's making it very clear. Jesus was very clear about it. You're not to go to work for money. You're not to go to work for making the house payment. You're not to go to work to... I will take care of you. Look at the birds of the air. Look at the lilies of the field, how they dress. And I take care of them. Your motivation is to serve me. When you go to work, it's to serve me. Not to serve your job. Not to serve money. But to serve me. And in that process, it's part of the sanctification. God help me. Don't feel like getting up. Don't feel like going. As a carpenter working outside at times over the years, you know, there's times when, oh man, I don't feel like, you know, it's 0 degrees outside. You know, I don't feel like going. It's part of, I would say, this not only sanctification of becoming a godly man, becoming a man as God has called us to be, you know. And God intends for us to work. God does not intend for us to be leeches. He does not intend for us to be takers. He intends for us to be givers and to pour out to other people and to give. Okay? But who do we, are we serving our job? And I think that's a question that all of us should ask. You know? Are we consumed all week in our job and what's going on around that? And do we try to squeeze in a little bit of time to serve the true and living God? They let the labor, the oppression of the labor come down and dominate and control. They went back to serving Pharaoh. And there's a couple of things here that I think are really important that exasperate disappointment. Because, again, I'm sorry, this isn't the sermon you might want to hear, but in this world you will be disappointed. Okay? But in that, what do we do with that? How do we deal with that? How do we honor God in our disappointment? How do we let disappointment be part of the sanctification process of growing? All we do is run from disappointment. We want nothing to do with it. We want to go to Disneyland, right? Forget this. I want to be happy. I want to pretend like everything's good. Obviously doesn't work. Doesn't work in marriage. Doesn't work in life. Doesn't work in business. Okay? There's a couple of things that I think exasperate. And they show up here to some degree. One of the greatest reasons for disappointment and things that exasperates. Again, God has a plan, right? God has a perfect plan that He's working in life. Period. For all of us. Okay? God has a perfect plan that He's working. But when it doesn't look like what we think it should look like, okay? What are the things, how do we, and we get disappointed or discouraged? One of the reasons that we put ourselves in a bad place oftentimes is half-hearted obedience. Okay? That's a primary one. Is half-hearted obedience. I don't know what level Moses, you know, you say, well, Moses was perfect, right? Oh, really? Didn't we just read the first 4 chapters, right? Struggled. God was really mad at him and was going to kill him. I don't think he's perfect. I think you look at half-hearted obedience. How about what we just read about last week? Circumcising his son. Okay? Did he understand that and know what was to be? Absolutely. To the extent that he educated his Midianite wife about it. And she knew about it. Right? Because when her, I don't know if it was her or Moses, was going to be killed and God was going to strike him dead, I mean, her son or Moses, she knew immediately what to do because she hadn't been fully obedient. And neither had Moses. Moses hadn't been fully obedient. Moses had a struggle with obedience, right? God said, go and tell Pharaoh. He goes, not me. I can't speak well. Right? Get Aaron, then Aaron can do it. We do this in a lot of things. We do it in morality. We do it in marriage, you know. So much of marriage and the disappointment in marriage. And if there's not disappointment in marriage, then again, you know, you're a liar. Marriage has disappointment, okay? No? Is somebody going, no, it's all good, right? It's all good. It's all good. It's not either. There's disappointment, right? He is not Prince Charming always, right? So, in spite of the fact that, you know, you will keep preaching that and saying that, it's not true, I know. So the disappointment in marriage often comes because we're half-heartedly obedient. What do we say? God, you told me to stick in this marriage. Okay, I'll stick in this marriage. You know what? God said to lay your life down for your wife. How about that part? Well, but I'm here, you know. I'm doing some things right. Right? No. We half-heartedly obey God and then hope and then get disappointed when he doesn't bless us. Get disappointed when we don't see his power in our life. What was the baseline? God's omnipotent power is most often, almost always, shown through obedience. Not half-hearted obedience. Right? Well, if I be pretty good, then that's good enough, right? No, God calls us to obedience. And he calls us to be obedient. He gives us his word. He says, this is my word. This is what I tell you. Be obedient to it. He says, the one who has my words and keeps them, that's the one that loves me, right? And the one that loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him, and I will disclose myself to him. Reveal himself to us. Anybody here not want God to reveal himself to us? That's why you're here. Right? In that hope that God will show himself in a more real and powerful way in our lives. Because we have this belief that we will be transformed by that and moved by that. You know what? God promises he will do that through obedience. Okay? So, not half-hearted obedience, saying, okay, God, I'll go halfway, you know? It's like most marriages. I mean, it's just amazing to me in watching and working through marriages with people, working through marriage counseling with people. Well, if they would, then I would, right? And I'm just waiting for him to come my way, and then I'll go their way. And God says, no, you're all in. Doesn't matter what they do. Doesn't matter how they act, you're all in. You be obedient in that way, then I'll show my power and begin to change. Another way is fear. Okay? One of the greatest things that leads to disappointment that paralyzes us, discouragement that paralyzes us, discouragement that makes us go, God, I forget it, God. I don't believe you. Where are you? Makes us angry at God. Can ruin our lives. I understand this. Fear that we let the enemy bring fear. That's what they did, right? The enemy brought fear in on these people, and they began to fear Pharaoh more than they feared God. Right? God had promised them. He'd heard, you know, what they'd said, and they began to fear Pharaoh more than God. Another one is forgetfulness. And I would say this is a primary one here. When we read it, it says, you know, God, how many times had God told Moses that Pharaoh was going to reject him? What he said? You know, 3 or 4 times. He said, you're going to go to Pharaoh, you're going to tell him to let my people go, and he's going to go, no. Right? And you're going to go to Pharaoh and you're going to tell him to let me go and he's going to go, no. And I'm going to harden his heart and he's not going to do it. And then when that happens, what does Moses say? God, what are you doing? Has anybody's life in here ever been blessed by God? Yeah? I would certainly hope so. I know this isn't, we're not charismatic, so don't raise your hands and say amen, you know, but you can do that. Okay? Amen. Okay? So, one of the things we often forget is God's faithfulness and God's blessing in our lives. Right? We get forgetful. You know, where are you, God? Do you realize where you are right now? You know? My wife is a constant reminder to God's faithfulness. Don't start crying. It's a constant reminder to God's faithfulness, you know, and God's goodness. And, you know, our marriage is, after 40 years, is better than it's ever been. And what I dreamed of, okay, in doing that. It wasn't always that way, okay? And God is faithful. And we forget that. It's easy in the midst of me and my optic view of life, and things don't seem to be, and I'm discouraged, and they aren't the way I thought they were supposed to be, and they don't look like this, to forget God's goodness, to forget God's faithfulness, to forget God's kindness at the cross again, you know? Wow, God died for us. God has a perfect plan for us, and He is in the process of working that plan. He is a loving Father, and has showed Himself to be a loving Father. Everybody in here, I would contend, on some level, has been wooed by God, drawn by God, right? God drew you, right? God drew you to Himself. And we might get the foolish feeling at times that, well, of course He did, right? Why wouldn't He? You know? Which would be idiocy, okay? It's because if we look at the perspective in reality, there wasn't a good reason, but God drew you. God continually pursued you. Because God is good. Because God is a loving Father. All of us on some level have had, no matter how blind we get or how foolish we get in our actions, all of us on some level have had the reality of God as a loving Father pursuing us. Right? If you haven't known that, there's a big wake-up that needs to happen. Because there's few things more important in life than that realization and that continual realization. You know, it's because in this process of discipline, in 1 John it says that God scourges those He loves. Scourges. That's like a beating, okay? That's not like swatting the butt, chasing around. Scourges those He loves. What happens when a 16-year-old gets spanked for the first time in his life? How does that go? Not well, right? Not gonna go well. What happens when a child is raised by a father that he trusts, by a father he knows has his best interests in mind, and he comes up in that process knowing his dad, number one, after a pretty young age, you're not spanking him anymore. Because his will is submitted and he trusts his father doing that. If you wait till 16, you're in deep trouble on doing it. The child can begin to trust his father, right? The child can begin to, I think of Becky, you know, doing it. And, you know, there was boys chasing her fanny around, you know, and wanting to marry her, my youngest daughter. And, what do you think, Dad? Nope. You know, and that was hard. This is somebody that wanted to let her heart go to and do it. And I think now, I mean, God brought Nate into her life. And now she's married and God has blessed her in the process. And she was able and willing to be content in that because she trusted me. Because we had a lifelong relationship with her father. That is so, I'm not trying to blow my whistle. I'm saying that we need to have that perspective of God. Okay? And we can cultivate that. We can cultivate that perspective that I can trust God because He's trustworthy. When I'm disappointed or I'm discouraged, I can trust Moses. Was he trusting God? Why have you brought harm to this people? And why did you ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak your name, he has done harm to this people, and you have not delivered this people at all. Oops. Right? He lost perspective. Well, God, you told me you wouldn't listen, right? Right, let's do this. No, he's mad. He's angry. He's discouraged in doing it because he lost perspective. He was forgetful of what God had done, of what God had promised, of what God had said. So, Moses is in process too. In spite of what we'd all think, you know, he went to the mountain, he was hanging out on the Sinai and got completely holy. So by the time he came back, he was perfect. Man, this had to be a little bit of a rough go. He came back in, we don't know how long it was even that he was there. We don't know how long he was back in Egypt, but he met with the elders. We tend to think he showed up one day, walked in, had the elder, went to Pharaoh the next day and did it and handled it. I don't know. We don't know time frame for sure how it looked like. But here it is, you know, he cultivated this relationship with the people. He did the miracles that God had shown. God revealed his power and who he was, this I am who I am God, this Lord that they had never known, called him by that name. He called him I am who I am. And they said, okay, I will trust you. Man, that didn't last long, did it? They turn around and the enemy comes against them and beats them up. And because they were forgetful, because we at this point have this, we have the cross, we have a tremendous amount of history that we are to fall back on. Oftentimes we tend to think that the God of this New Testament is a lot more casual, a lot more lax, you know. Now, because Jesus died on the cross, sin doesn't really an issue and doesn't really matter, and so God's a lot more lax and a lot more casual about it. Let me just say, I would contend it's the opposite. We have tools that they never had in the Old Testament. We have the Spirit of God, right? He says that dwells, comes and lives in us. We have the Word of God that He has miraculously written and preserved for us to do. We have the cross, and we can look back at the cross. We can look at the historical fact of the cross and what God did in intervening on the earth. We don't have to wonder what the Messiah, I would contend, we're probably just as confused about what's going to happen in end times. Pardon me. You know, eschatology to me is something that's really, and whenever I hear somebody have it figured and dialed and wired, I go, really? Have you ever looked in history? It doesn't go well. You know, when you think you have it figured. How it will look in the end, I don't know, but I do know how it looked at the cross. And I do know how the power of the cross. God calls us to himself, and we have very little excuse. We just have to use the tools that he's given us and the resources that he's given us. When we are discouraged and without hope, let it reveal our hearts. Look at our hearts. It's important to be introspective. And look at your heart and go, I mean, Moses should have stood up and go, what did I just say to God? I would hope he did. You know, and do a little bit of this. You know, what did I just do? Let's pray. God, we don't really have an excuse. You have provided everything necessary to have an intimate relationship with you. We let the world, as Pharaoh did, impose this laborious burden on us. Money, of debt, of houses, of all the things that we can tend to do. We've got bills, we've got to pay for power, we've got to pay for electricity, we've got to pay for all the things we've got to pay for. We let that burden control us and consume us and cause us to serve something other than you. You've given us the resources. You've given us the history of the cross. You've given us the truth of the cross. You've given us the absoluteness of what happened on the cross. You've called us all. All of us here have some personal history, some personal understanding of you drawing us, of your love as a father towards us. We act like spoiled little brats at times and don't want to remember. But you've given us those resources. The enemy wants to come in and strike fear in us and make our disappointment overwhelm us and cause us to doubt you. That's not where it should take us. We can be disappointed in this world and have perfect peace. We can have turmoil in this world and have perfect peace. Hard times are not something that we should run from. God, please cause us to realize that you have a plan, that you're working. Our issue is, are we obedient? Our issue is, are we serving you? Our issue is, are we honoring you and worshiping you with our lives? And if that's the case, then let's go for this ride. Whatever it may bring, and oftentimes it didn't. I thank you as David, who had to be one of those who was highly, it didn't go the way he thought it would. He wanted more than anything to build your temple. He wanted more than anything to sit before you in the house of worship. You gave him plans. You gave him what it would look like, how to do it. And then you said he couldn't do it. Because you'd called him for a different purpose. You'd called him to be a warrior. You called him to be, to set Israel free from their enemies. I'm sure he was disappointed. And yet, David said, I would have despaired if I couldn't believe that I'd see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. And I thank you that you are a good father. He gives good gifts to his children. We shouldn't live in, it doesn't say discouragement, disappointment. Shouldn't leave us without hope. Shouldn't leave us without peace. And shouldn't leave us without joy. You say, blessed are those who mourn. How happy are those who mourn. God, I ask that you would cause us to go through the things of this world with the recognition that you're a loving dad who's in control. In remembrance of the things that you've done, in remembrance of the things you've promised, in obedience to you with our lives. Cause us to help each other, God, in this process of when we are discouraged and get very myopic and looking right in front of ourselves and gazing at our belly button, that we would encourage each other to look up and recognize who you are. Question who we serve and how we serve and how we've gotten off track of service. I thank you. I thank you for the family that we're not in this alone. I thank you that you are a God of all hope. I thank you, Jesus, for making that absolutely clear. Giving us the opportunity to have a relationship with God, with your Father. Amen.